Today is Wednesday, September the 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken defended the U.S. evacuation from Afghanistan for the first time before a congressional panel on Monday.
We did not see this collapse in a matter of 11 days.
And a new report says that a network of Kenyan Twitter influencers are being paid by unknown political operatives to launch online disinformation attacks targeting activists and members of the country's judiciary.
They coordinate some of this disinformation campaigns through the use of WhatsApp groups. And then once they hit the, you know, KPIs, then they receive their money through the mobile platform M-Pesa.
And the Taliban are denying reports that one of their top leaders was killed in a shootout with rivals. Those stories and more coming up right here on Voice of America. Stay tuned. And for our top story, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken defended the U.S. evacuation from Afghanistan for the first time before a congressional panel on Monday. Lawmakers, Republicans, as well as several Democrats, criticized the Biden administration's handling of the chaotic August withdrawal that ended the longest war in U.S. history. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more.
2 weeks after the last U.S. flight left Kabul, ending the nearly 20-year U.S. military involvement in Afghanistan, U.S. lawmakers questioning Biden administration officials for the first time for failing to anticipate the Taliban's rapid takeover of the country and for sticking to an August 31st deadline for the U.S. withdrawal. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
There's no evidence that staying longer would have made the Afghan security forces or the Afghan government any more resilient or self-sustaining. If 20 years and hundreds of billions of dollars in support, equipment, and training did not suffice, why would another year, another five, another 10?
The administration has defended the chaotic and deadly evacuation that turned into the largest airlift in U.S. history. The U.S. and its allies evacuated 124,000 people, most of them Afghans, after the fall of Kabul on August 15th. Republicans say the White House could have avoided those images of chaos, which damaged the United States' reputation internationally. Republican Representative Steve Chabot.
We went into Afghanistan in the first place because the Taliban had harbored Al-Qaeda. Correct. And they attacked us on September 11th. Now, 20 years later, we have the Taliban back in charge there, and they have billions and billions of dollars worth of our equipment and our weaponry. And once again, they're a haven for terrorists. How is this not a debacle of monumental proportions?
Blinken telling lawmakers that while the U.S. effort in Afghanistan did neutralize the threat from Al-Qaeda, there was a larger lesson to learn about U.S. involvement overseas. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
While we are very effective at dealing with terrorist threats to our country and eliminating them, which we did very successfully in Afghanistan, the idea of using military force to try to remake a society is something that is beyond our means and beyond our capacity. And we need to think really hard about whether we want to engage in these enterprises going forward.
And while some Democratic lawmakers have criticized the way the White House handled the withdrawal, they argue Biden was put in an impossible situation by the deal negotiated by former President Donald Trump. Democratic Representative Gregory Meeks.
Let me remind everyone that Trump's deal forced the Afghan government to release 5,000 prisoners and offered international legitimacy to the Taliban. It was a deal that failed to require the Taliban to separate from Al-Qaeda terrorists and did not require the Taliban to stop attacking the Afghan government. The deal altered the political order of the country.
The U.S. has not recognized the Taliban as the official government of Afghanistan. Blinken said Monday that about 100 Americans are waiting to be evacuated from Afghanistan and that the State Department was accelerating the approval process for Afghan special immigrant visa applicants. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
Turkey is calling for collective international action to deal with the humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan. The call comes as Turkey, already hosting the largest number of refugees globally, warns that it cannot take any more. For VOA, Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Çavuşoğlu, addressing a high-level United Nations meeting on Afghanistan Monday, warned that with millions of Afghans displaced and facing a humanitarian crisis, now is the time for collective action.
A humanitarian and security crisis in Afghanistan will have direct implications across the globe. So we should take the collective action now.
Turkish leaders fear an Afghan exodus through its territory as refugees flee Afghanistan and head for Europe. Last week, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, paid a four-day visit to Turkey and praised the country for receiving nearly 4 million refugees who fled the Syrian civil war. Under a deal with the European Union, Turkey gets billions of dollars in aid to host the Syrians. Some EU leaders are already suggesting the agreement be extended to include Afghans, claiming refugees should be hosted in locations closest to their places of origin. But Turkey's main opposition, CHP party, is strongly critical of the government's refugee policy. Ünal Çeviköz is a CHP parliamentary deputy.
It is a record of serious mismanagement. It was simply a kind of transactional type of relationship between Turkey and the European Union. And they simply wanted to stop the flow of refugees by giving some financial assistance to Turkey. A majority of the Turkish population think that burden sharing is not fairly distributed in the international community. And we are also scared that the same mismanagement will continue in the case of Afghanistan.
Senior EU officials visited Ankara last week to talk about the refugee deal with Turkey. Ankara insists it cannot take any more refugees and calls for the EU to share the burden. Some analysts say Ankara needs the money from Europe, but international relations expert Soli Özel says Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan will need more than monetary incentives to convince his people.
He will have to show to the country something more than just money, and that's visa liberalization, which I doubt the Europeans are capable of delivering on.
Visa-free travel for Turks in the European Union was part of the original Syrian refugee deal, but until now has been blocked by some EU members. With Erdogan's ratings languishing at record lows in opinion polls, and the same polls indicating strong public opposition to receiving Afghan refugees, analysts predict any new EU refugee deal with Turkey will be difficult and fraught with political risk for the Turkish leader. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
The US Census Bureau says that the share of Americans living in poverty rose slightly last year. For more, AP correspondent Shelley Adler reports.
The Census Bureau says the share of Americans living in poverty rose slightly last year. The COVID-19 pandemic shook the economy last year, but massive relief payments pumped out by Congress eased hardship for many. According to the Census Bureau, the official poverty measure showed an increase of 1 percentage point in 2020, indicating that 11.4% of Americans were living in poverty. It was the first such increase after 5 consecutive annual declines. But a more complete supplemental measure of poverty, which takes into account income streams such as stimulus payments, actually showed that the share of people in poverty dipped after the aid was factored in. I'm Shelley Adler.
And in New York, a judge has blocked the medical worker vaccine mandate in the state. AP correspondent Walter Ratliff has more.
A judge has blocked the medical worker vaccine mandate in New York State. A federal judge has temporarily blocked the state of New York from forcing medical workers to be vaccinated after a group of healthcare workers sued. 17 health professionals, including doctors and nurses, claim the vaccine mandate violates their rights because it disallows religious exemptions. The court papers said all of the available vaccines employ aborted fetus cell lines in their testing, development, or production. The suit says the plaintiffs are not anti-vaxxers, but they oppose any medical cooperation in abortion as a matter of religious conviction. I'm Walter Ratliff.
A UN investigative body finds what it calls an alarming upsurge in fighting and violence, with some incidents amounting to war crimes and crimes against humanity. 10 years into Syria's civil war. The report by the UN Syria Commission of Inquiry will be submitted to the UN Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The commission began investigating alleged violations of international human rights law in Syria in August 2011, 5 months after civil war broke out. The three-member panel now says conditions in Syria look increasingly bleak. It reports fighting and violence have been intensifying in recent months in the northwest, northeast, and south of the country. It reports civilians are having difficulty finding a haven in this war-torn country. Commission member Hani Magali says the lulling hostilities in northwestern Idlib province, brought about by a March 2020 ceasefire agreement brokered by Russia and Turkey, has ended. Magali says it began unraveling with increased Syrian and Russian airstrikes and shelling of this last rebel-held territory.
In terms of the crimes, you know, the attacks on the aerial attacks and bombardments that are hitting civilian objects, schools, hospitals, marketplaces, etc., detentions, torture in detention, deaths in custody, the sexual gender-based violence, you know, unfortunately, even cases of rape.
The report finds several areas are under siege by pro-government forces, trapping thousands of civilians without enough food or health care. The investigators also accuse the terrorist organization Hayat Tahrir al-Sham of imposing restrictions on media and freedom of expression in areas under its control in the northwest. The commission accuses the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces of unlawfully interning thousands of women and children in camps across northeast Syria. Commission Chair Paolo Pinheiro says one of the most scandalous features is the situation of an estimated 40,000 children held in Al-Hol and other camps. Pinheiro says nearly half are Iraqi, while 7,800 come from nearly 60 other countries. He says only some 1,000 foreign children have been released and brought home. Most foreign children, he notes, remain deprived of their liberty because their home countries refuse to repatriate them.
Most are under 12 years old. No one accused them of crimes yet for over 3 years. They have been held in horrifying conditions. Protection can never mean indefinite detention of children. The first remedy for an unlawful detention is release. Punishing children for the sins of their parents cannot be justified.
UN and international agencies estimate Syria's decade-long war has killed about 500,000 people and forcibly displaced 13.5 million, both internally and as refugees in neighboring countries. The UN Commission says it is not safe for refugees to return to Syria, given the upsurge in violence and human rights violations, the unstable political situation, the plummeting economy, and fast-spreading COVID-19 pandemic. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Voice of America. In a message of inclusion, Pope Francis is reaching out to the Roma people of Slovakia, where he has condemned Central Europe's historic marginalization of communities, including Jews. For VOA, Sabina Casafranco reports from Rome.
On his second day in Slovakia, the Pope traveled to the town of Prešov in the eastern part of the country, where he celebrated Mass in the Byzantine Rite in the city's sports stadium. The highlight of the day was a visit to the Roma community in the nearby town of Košice, a gesture analysts see as a sign of inclusion. The impoverished Lunik neighborhood, which the Pope will visit, is home to the country's highest community of Roma residents, where his message is welcomed by a population living with problems that include overcrowded housing, in some cases with no running water or electricity. Slovakia has a 400,000-strong Roma minority, which has historically faced discrimination. On Monday, the Pope addressed the Slovak president and other officials in the gardens of Bratislava's presidential palace and stressed the need to work for the common good and not focus on individual needs. Referring to the nation's communist past, the Pope said that until a few decades ago, a single thought system stifled freedom, adding that today another such system is emptying freedom of meaning, reducing progress to profit and rights only to individual means. Pope Francis said, "Fraternity is necessary for the increasingly pressing process of integration." The Pope also addressed representatives of the Jewish community on Monday at a memorial for Jews that were killed in the Holocaust. At this site, a synagogue was demolished in 1969 in what the Pope said were efforts to cancel every trace of the Jewish community. Here in this place, the Pope said, the name of God was dishonored, for the worst form of blasphemy is to exploit it for our purposes, refusing to respect and love others. More than 100,000 Slovak Jews were killed during the Holocaust, and the Pope added that it was shameful how people who said they believed in God perpetrated or allowed unspeakable acts of inhumanity. The Jewish community in Slovakia now amounts to some 2,000 people. Pope Francis said, "Let us unite in condemning all violence and every form of anti-Semitism." An open-air mass in the Slovak town of Saštin Wednesday caps the pontiff's visit before his return to Rome. The visit to Hungary and Slovakia is his first foreign trip since the Pope underwent colon surgery in July. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
And in more headline news, the Taliban have denied that one of their top leaders, Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar, was killed in a shootout with rivals following rumors about internal splits in the movement nearly a month after entering Kabul. And France's foreign minister has criticized plans that would bring Russian mercenaries into Mali. He says that such a move was, quote, incompatible with the French military presence in the country. Reuters reports that a deal between Mali's ruling junta and the Russian private military contractor, the Wagner Group, would bring in mercenaries to train the Malian military and provide protection for senior officials. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Early last year, social media giant Twitter announced that it would deploy new features to help curb disinformation and influence operations that use the platform to target political and social campaigns around the world. In the U.S., Twitter's new strict rules targeted accounts that spread fake news and disinformation related to the 2020 elections and later issues such as COVID-19 and the COVID vaccine. In Africa, a GSMA report from 2019 showed that mobile social media penetration increased to 11% from 5% in 2015. The double-digit increase can be seen in the number of people on the continent that use popular platforms such as YouTube, Facebook, WhatsApp, and Twitter. And with almost 50 million Twitter users, Kenya has one of the most engaged Twitter communities on the continent, many tweeting under the acronym hashtag KOT, or Kenyans on Twitter. They use the platform to engage in debate and mobilize around issues of shared concern. However, a new report says that the platform is being used by some people with sinister motives. Brian Obilo is a cybersecurity engineer, currently a tech and society fellow at Mozilla Foundation. He specializes in cybersecurity, cyber resilience, cyber awareness, and disinformation. Brian is the co-writer of the report titled, quote, "Inside the Shadowy World of Disinformation for Hire in Kenya." From Nairobi, he tells me that their report uncovered a network of Kenyan Twitter influencers who were paid by political operatives to launch online disinformation attacks targeting activists and members of the country's judiciary to undermine their work on contentious political issues of the day.
So for some of the influencers, some of them commercialize their following. So we have seen a lot of influencers get into paid partnerships with multiple brands in order to sort of just boost their career forward and stuff like that. Others can use it for social activism. Others are using it to amplify key social justice issues that are happening. And also for politicians, they're using their following to sort of promote or advance their agendas and whatnot. So it just depends on
their political platforms.
Yes. Right. So it just depends on who the influencer is and what they intend to do.
Okay.
With their following. And
this report that you co-authored says that, you know, shadowy financiers have deployed an army of Twitter influencers to coordinate disinformation campaigns in favor of either a government, in this specific case, a government-backed constitution amendment bill that is popularly known as BBI, or was known as BBI, Building Bridges Initiative. Who are these financiers, and are there other similar campaigns against government initiatives or bills in parliaments or even politicians?
Yeah, I think that's a question we receive a lot. So one of the sources that talked to us told us that, first of all, they organize some of this disinformation, they coordinate some of this disinformation campaigns through the use of WhatsApp groups. And then once they hit the, you know, KPIs, then they receive their money through the mobile platform M-Pesa. So the people that are probably paying them are middlemen. So it's very, very hard to really trace that money and get the right people who are sort of financing the disinformation campaigns themselves. But at the end of the day, the most important question you can always ask yourself, and without a rhetorical question you can ask yourself, is who stands to benefit the most by sort of amplifying the Building Bridges initiative, and also at the same time pushing dissenting voices, or rather opposing voices, away from the platform. So it's very, very hard to answer that question, but that's how you can put it, like who stands to benefit from it.
Okay, so whoever benefits is the one who's most likely paying, but it's very hard to trust the money directly to them.
Yes, exactly.
Are there any local laws that they're breaking by engaging in disinformation campaigns?
So in Kenya, we have the Computer Misuse and Cybercrimes Act that essentially forbids you from publishing false information. So it's not very clear, because of the nature of the disinformation they're spewing, whether they're breaking any laws. And also some of the disinformation we saw may constitute to maybe libel and defamation, especially the ones that the five judges of the High Court received. Some of the attacks they received may constitute to libel and this. So it's not very clear which laws they are breaking per se, but I guess it may depend on a case-by-case basis of every disinformation campaign and the exact content of what they were pushing out there.
Does, you know, we know in the US, Twitter actively last year was blocking accounts that were engaged in disinformation campaigns, whether it's against COVID vaccines, or whether it was political campaigns. Has there been any such initiative in Kenya where Twitter has actually gone as far as blocking or deactivating an account for engaging in that type of activity?
Yeah, so one thing I can mention is that when we reached out to Twitter with this, they first of all thanked us for bringing this to their attention. And they conducted their own internal investigation, and their teams took action on just over 100 Twitter accounts that they believed had sort of violated their platform manipulation and spam policy. And while giving us feedback on the same, they told us that they had found one network of coordinated accounts, which sort of link back to other accounts that were deactivated in 2020 last year. So this just shows the resilience of some of these groups that are conducting the disinformation campaigns. And even if Twitter takes action, they find ways in which they can set up more accounts to continue violating Twitter's platform manipulation and spam policy. So there is still so much more to be done, because from these campaigners' perspective, Twitter is a very lucrative platform, and it's very, very efficient for spreading disinformation because of some of the key features that the platform itself has, like its own trending algorithm and whatnot.
That was Brian Obilo, a cybersecurity engineer, currently a tech and society fellow at Mozilla Foundation. Brian is the co-writer of the report titled Inside the Shadowy World of Disinformation for Hire in Kenya. I reached him in Nairobi, and we'll bring you the second part of our conversation tomorrow. A report submitted to the UN Human Rights Council blasts the Nicaraguan government's harsh crackdown on opposition leaders in advance of November 7th presidential and parliamentary elections. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Critics accused Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega of systematically ridding himself of viable opposition candidates to secure a fourth consecutive term as president of the country. In her latest update to the council, UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet says increasing restrictions by Nicaraguan authorities on people's right to vote are undermining free and fair elections. She says Nicaraguans should be able to exercise their right to vote without intimidation, violence, or administrative interference. Her report documents the arbitrary detention of 16 people between June 22nd and September 6th. They include political leaders, human rights defenders, business people, journalists, as well as peasant and student leaders. She says these arrests are in addition to 20 other government opponents who have been detained since May 28th. She speaks through an interpreter.
This group includes six men and one woman who have publicly stated that they were aspiring to the presidency. The large majority of these people remain deprived of their liberty and have been so for up to 90 days, being held incommunicado, some in isolation, without any official confirmation as to their whereabouts from the authorities to their families.
The public prosecutor's office says most of the people detained are accused of conspiracy to undermine national integrity and other crimes linked to the implementation of cooperation funds. Human Rights Chief Bachelet says attacks on freedom of expression and against the media and journalists have intensified. She says similar patterns of repression are being registered against human rights defenders, social and political leaders, among others. She speaks through an interpreter.
Given this deteriorating situation in Nicaragua, it is essential that the government once again guarantee the full enjoyment of civil and political rights of all Nicaraguans, that they put an end to persecution of the opposition, press and civil society, and that they immediately and unconditionally release the over 130 persons detained since April 2018, according to civil society sources.
The Nicaraguan government has consistently brushed off UN and international criticism, claiming it is based on disinformation from North American and European countries seeking to maintain their colonial grip on the country. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day ahead.
A message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
The World Health Organization and Africa Center for Disease Control say we all can help fight the global pandemic by frequently washing our hands with soap and water or using hand sanitizers. For more information on protecting yourself and others, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa Center for Disease Control. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.